Good morning, everyone. This is the session on female-initiated HIV prevention technology. My name is Ken Mayer. I'm from Brown University and Fenway Community Health in the United States. I'm very honored to co-chair this session with Dr. Roberto Black of the National Institutes of Allergy and Infectious Diseases in the United States, who has been a tireless advocate for excellent science to study female-controlled methods of prevention. Our topic today, a very important topic, and there's going to be other very important data presented at this meeting, including late-breaking sessions. But it's very important for us to keep in mind that to do these studies ethically, responsibly, requires an incredible amount of effort. There have been something on the order of more than 30,000 women who've consented to participate in these studies in resource-constrained environments, and the investigators have invested enormous effort in engaging the community and in trying to make optimal sense of the research. So despite some of the gratuitous comments that have been circulated in the lay media and the scientific media, I think that this field is moving forward, and today we're going to be hearing some very important study results. Our speakers will each be speaking for approximately 10 minutes, and then we'll hopefully, if they're able to stay on time, have about 5 minutes for questions and answers. We have a very full program this morning. Our first speaker is Dr. Charlene Govinda from South Africa, and she will be speaking on factors contributing to diaphragm size change among enrolled women at the Durban site in a phase 3 HIV prevention clinical trial.
Good afternoon to the chairs and fellow delegates, and thank you to the conference organizers for this opportunity. I would like to acknowledge my fellow authors in the preparation of this trial. As we are all aware, the statistics for HIV globally are alarmingly increasing. According to the December 2006 statistics, nearly 39.5 million people were living with HIV globally, with nearly 25 million being from sub-Saharan Africa alone, where nearly 60% of the population living with HIV are women. In South Africa, the HIV prevalence rate is 32%. Although current prevention strategies such as condom use, monogamy, and the treatment of STIs are being implemented, these are often unavailable or not feasible due to socioeconomic factors. Research is therefore now assessing the effectiveness of other prevention technologies such as microbicides, vaccines, male circumcision, and cervical barrier devices such as the diaphragm. Traditionally, the diaphragm is a contraceptive female-controlled device which covers the cervix, which research has found increases the risk of women acquiring infections due to an increase in the concentration of receptors at the site and a fragile epithelium. The diaphragm was recently tested as a prospective HIV prevention method in a clinical trial called MIRA, where women had to initially be fit with the diaphragm and were refit if indicated. Some of the results have been discussed earlier in this conference and will be discussed later as well. As participants had required initial fitting and subsequent refitting if indicated, the purpose of this presentation was to determine what were the factors that contributed to diaphragm size changes in order to better inform future fitting practices for cervical barrier devices. Currently, there is much debate and controversy surrounding the need for diaphragm fitting, and information regarding the need is limited. A recent paper also showed that a common diaphragm size used among women across age groups was a size 70 millimeter diaphragm, which I will be discussing later as well. MIRA was a prospective randomized clinical trial which assessed the effectiveness of the diaphragm and lubricant vaginal gel against the acquisition of HIV and STIs among heterosexual women. The trial was conducted in three sites. The one was Harare, Zimbabwe, where 502 women were enrolled, Soweto, Johannesburg, South Africa, where 1,028 women were enrolled, and two sites in Durban with Umkomaz and Bothas Hill, both rural areas, where 1,515 women were enrolled. Although every prospective participant was provided with a package of care, for the purpose of this presentation, I will be focusing on the participants enrolled in the trial. So from the 1,515 women enrolled, 757 women were randomized into the diaphragm replenish gel and condom arm, while the remaining 758 were randomized into the condom-only arm. Every participant was provided with access and ongoing access to VCT, male condoms, safe sex and risk reduction counseling, the diagnosis and treatment of STIs, and education and information regarding the diaphragm and condom use. Demonstrations were performed by trained staff to initially just introduce the idea of the correct techniques of diaphragm insertion and removal using pelvic models, following which participants were allowed to also practice with the use of pelvic models. Physical exams were then done to exclude any contraindications to diaphragm use before participants were fit by trained clinicians and nurses for the most correct diaphragm size. Participants had to demonstrate the ability to correctly insert and remove the diaphragm and gel before being eligible for randomization. Diaphragm sizes were checked if the participant had a complaint regarding the product use, had experienced a vaginal delivery or stillbirth in the third trimester, or it was her closing visit and she had not been refit in the past 6 months. Participants were informed that they could return to the clinic at any time should they require any information or experience any problems or concerns with the diaphragm. So we analyzed the data using both qualitative and quantitative methods, and we looked at fixed variables such as the diaphragm size at enrollment and at follow-up, what were the indications for the changes in the diaphragm size. From the data analysis for participants in the diaphragm replens gel and condom arm, we found a very nice curve, a bell curve, with the distribution of diaphragms between women ages 18 to 45, with the most common diaphragm sizes ranging from 65 to 75 millimeters. The 274 women were issued with a size 70 millimeter diaphragm, which could impact on future needs for fitting of diaphragms and cervical barrier devices, as this was the most common size. Of the 757 women in the diaphragm replens gel and condom arm, 289 required diaphragm refits. So we wanted to assess what were these factors that contributed to this. One of the factors, as can be seen in the pie graph on the right, was pregnancy related, where 96 women were refit and had diaphragm size changes following vaginal deliveries and or a spontaneous miscarriage in the third trimester. 48 women were refit following participant complaints, and this could have been pain on insertion or with the diaphragm use, or just a feeling of discomfort with the diaphragm that merited a refit and resulted in a diaphragm size change. Then there were other factors which we grouped together as other factors, and these were where 145 women were refit. And these factors were where the participant might have lost her diaphragm and needed to be refit, or had damage to the diaphragm, or a clinician discretion warranted a refit in the diaphragm, or as a part of quality assurance, where the monitor suggested a refit or with weight changes as well. So these were some of the factors that contributed to the other reasons. So although 38% of the women require diaphragm refits, we can say that diaphragm fitting was reasonably consistent, with 68% of the women not requiring diaphragm size changes and with them remaining on the diaphragm size initially fitted. The factors that contributed to these changes can be briefly summarized as pregnancy, participant complaints, and the group of other factors which I just discussed in the previous slide. So in order to ensure adequate protection is provided by the diaphragm as an effective contraceptive device or a possible protective device against STIs or HIV infection, we must evaluate participants' complaints and exclude any other factors that might contribute to the complaint. Another recommendation is that we monitor weight, as is done with most of the contraceptive methods. We monitor weight as gross changes, normally of greater than 4.5 kilograms and more, could result in inadequate coverage of the cervix by the diaphragm and therefore reduce effectiveness of contraception. We also recommend that any pregnancy outcome with a pregnancy greater than or equal to a 14-week gestation warrant a refit as changes in the uterine musculature could result in inadequate coverage again of the cervix. And it's very important that participants are provided with adequate and correct information and access to information regarding the diaphragm consistently, and also what the indications for refit are in order to better understand this. I would like to acknowledge and thank the participants of the study, the research team at the HIV Prevention Research Unit, the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, MIRA, IBIS Reproductive Health, the University of California, San Francisco, and GMOR, for their assistance in this presentation. Thank you.
Thank you. You may want to stay up there. You can. And this presentation is now open for discussion. Please come to the mic and introduce yourselves, those who have questions. Is there any reason to wonder whether having to have changes in the diaphragm in the course of the trial had any impact on adherence to usage?
It might have. It might have. Unfortunately, for this presentation, I did not analyze that data, so it could have been a possible reason as well for it.
Yeah, I was just curious, were any of the participant complaints actually their male partner complaints, or was it just always the participant complaining about discomfort?
Well, there were some incidences where the participant's partner had maybe complained that they had felt the diaphragm in situ, but the majority of the complaints were where the participant just was uncomfortable with the diaphragm.
Dr. McDermott?
Yeah, G. McDermott from the Fogarty International Center. Yeah, can you tell us a little bit more about this refitting and what, were there people whose their sizes went up, their sizes went down? If you redid that curve, what would it look like for after people were refitted? So in other words, do you have really drastic changes, or are they just going up and down one size and probably that wouldn't change so much the efficacy of the diaphragm?
Well, in this presentation, unfortunately, that information was not available before this presentation. But in practice, very often the sizes change just by one size or two sizes.
Did they go up or down mostly?
Most of the time, it was down.
Down.
Mm-hmm. Kim Collins from Australia. Just wondering what the cost of a diaphragm is and whether that's a barrier for what you're doing.
Well, in South Africa, it is not available in the government clinics, and it is on offer in the private sector, and they range from anything from, I think, around 50 to 100 rand for the device. So that's in South Africa alone, but it's not commonly used at all.
Yeah, in Australia, it's about $70, $80, and you're replacing them every 18 months, and that's often a barrier for some people to use it for a
the cost itself, yeah.
Thank you. Thank you, Dr. Govinder. And we'll hear more about the diaphragm and gel adherence in a safety trial in Harare, Zimbabwe, from Dr. Ariane van der Straaten, representing a team from the United States and the University of Zimbabwe in Harare. Sure. You make my one good one there.
I just wanted to make a quick remark about the cost of the diaphragm. So the initial cost may be slightly higher than other contraceptives, but it's a reusable device that can be used for many years, so the cost per use ends up being fairly cheap. So today I'm going to be talking about another study, which is not the MIRA trial. My other colleagues later, Liz Montgomery and Connie, will talk again about MIRA, but this presentation is about a study called the Diaphragm and Microbicide Safety Trial, which was conducted in Zimbabwe and funded by CONRAD. The title of my presentation is Diaphragm and Gel Use in a Safety Trial in Zimbabwe. So the DMS study design was a first phase one randomized controlled trial to assess the safety and acceptability of 6 months of use of diaphragm with active gel diaphragm with placebo gel and active gel alone. The participants, staff, and investigators were blinded to the gel in the two diaphragm arms, but were not blinded to the gel in the gel-only arm. The study was conducted in Harare. The main eligibility criteria for the trial was for women to be 18 to 49 years old, sexually active, non-pregnant, using an effective contraceptive, having no reproductive tract infection or STI and a healthy cervix, and being able to correctly insert and remove the diaphragm prior to randomization. I already presented findings on the safety of the trial, today the objective of this presentation is to talk about product use and examine level of product use during the trial, compare assigned product adherence between diaphragm and gel groups versus gel-only group, and to examine predictors of adherence. This is a slide depicting the study flow for the trial. We screened 476 women and randomized 119 into the three groups, diaphragm and placebo gel, diaphragm and active gel only. There was no difference in early withdrawal or termination between the three arms. For the purpose of this analysis, we did combine the two diaphragm and gel arm into one group of 77 women. Among those, we had to exclude one woman who had no follow-up data and one woman who reported no sex during the 6 months of follow-up. So our total analytical sample is 117. We had a median follow-up visit of 5, ranging from 1 to 6 visits. Our study products were the Ortho Olflex latex diaphragm, like in the MIRA trial you previously heard about, and this was fitted by a trained clinician. In terms of gel, our active gel was 6% sodium cellulose sulfate, which is a contraceptive agent and has a broad antimicrobial activity. And our placebo was KY jelly. We also promoted and distributed actively condom use, a condom at every visit. In terms of product use, it was a coitally dependent use of the products, and the instructions we gave to the women was to, prior to each act of sex in the diaphragm and gel groups, to empty one gel applicator in the dome of the diaphragm and then insert the diaphragm in the vagina, then to empty another gel applicator in the vagina 1 hour or less prior to sex, and to use a male condom for every sex act. In the gel-only group, women were told to empty a gel applicator in the vagina 1 hour or less prior to sex and to use male condoms for every sex act. We did monthly interview and looked at product use at last sex by ACASI. We also looked on screen by the clinician form at the last date products were used, and we assessed monthly problems with study products. At exit, we looked at frequency of use in the past 3 months, which was our main measure of adherence, and we asked women whether they always, sometimes, or never use their assigned study products. We also assessed acceptability and product rating. In terms of analysis, we conducted a GAE for time-dependent analysis to look at repeated measure of product use at last sex, and we used multivariate logistic regression to compare women reporting always using versus less than always using their assigned study products. On this slide is shown the baseline characteristic. Overall, characteristics were well balanced between arms. And overall, the mean age of women was 29. Their mean weekly sexual frequency was 5.4. It was predominantly a married monogamous sample, with 96.6% of women being married and 76% of women having only one lifetime partner. Women had experience with male condoms at baseline. 85% had ever used a male condom, and 27% reported always using one in the past month. In contrast, only 38% had ever heard of the diaphragm, and only 3 women, that's 2.6%, had ever used a diaphragm prior to the trial. Similarly, only 22% had ever heard of a vaginal gel, and only 5 women had ever used a vaginal gel. The primary contraceptive method that women used was the pill, 72%. Other methods used were injectable, Norplant, IUD, and TL. And again, by design, we asked all women to be on hormonal contraceptive or long-term contraceptive to be enrolled in the trial. The HIV prevalence in this sample was 26%. This slide shows product use overall and by group. First, we assessed through monthly assessment, and we present cumulative average of product use. As measured by the clinician form, we first looked at combination of diaphragm and gel use among women in the diaphragm and gel group. And 89% of the visits, women report that the last time they used a diaphragm, they also used gel, which shows that there was a high level of combined method use in the diaphragm and gel groups. The next row shows the product use at last sex as measured by ACASI, again, cumulative average. Overall, 70.5% of sex acts were covered by a study product during the study, but this differed by groups. In the diaphragm and gel group, 66% of last sex acts were protected by the assigned study product versus 80% in the gel only. When we looked at the main adherence outcome, which was a product used in the past 3 months at exit, overall, 58% of women said they always use their assigned study product, and this did not differ by group. 59% in the diaphragm and gel group versus 56% in the gel-only group. This is a slide showing product use at last sex by visit. The red line depicts the women in the gel group, and the blue line depicts women in the diaphragm and gel group. And the odds ratio for using study product at last sex was 0.48 with a p-value of 0.017. So there was a significant difference between the two groups as measured at last sex. However, when we looked at always use in the past 3 months, there was no effect, there was no treatment effect. And the odds ratio for always using study product comparing diaphragm and gel versus women in the gel-only group was 1.15 with a non-significant p-value. We also looked at other predictors of always use. Age was significantly associated with a greater likelihood of always using product. In univariate analysis, parity and years in relationship were, but they didn't remain significant in the multivariate adjusted model. Sexual frequency, partners having multiple partners, contraceptive use, and HIV status were not associated with always use, and neither was problems with the study products, which, by the way, was extremely low. Only 9 women report any problems with their products over the course of the trial. However, use of condom at every sex act was strongly associated with always using study product. And this association remains significant in the multivariate analysis with an odds ratio of 3.85. Using study product for pregnancy and or disease prevention was univariately associated with always use, but not in the multivariate model. And similarly, strongly liking one study product was significantly associated in the univariate, but not in the multivariate model. Women who reported that their partner thinks that using a product is a good idea were more likely to always use their product as well. In summary, when we looked at a measure of always use or adherence as always use, or and compare it to our measure of product use at last sex, we didn't get the same picture. Our summary measure showed no difference by group in always use, whereas when we looked at product use at last sex, women in the gel group report higher product use than women in the diaphragm and gel group. The independent predictors of always using one's assigned product included consistently using condoms, age, and partner's approval for product. The overall acceptability of assigned study product was high, but it was not independently associated with product adherence. And few problems were reported with products. However, adherence or always using product was lower than expected, especially in the context of a trial. In conclusion, product adherence was measured was similar between groups, even though a diaphragm and gel combination may seem more complex to use than a gel alone. Adherence to both condoms and products was strongly associated. This may bias effectiveness results in future trial of female-controlled methods, as it will be difficult to extricate the effect of the female control method from that of condoms. And given the slightly different picture we got from our different measure of product use, better, more objective biomarkers measure of products and condom use are needed so that we can decrease our reliance on self-reported use of products. I would like to acknowledge my colleagues at UCSF, University of Zimbabwe, and Conrad. Thank you.
Thank you, Dr. van der Straaten. We can take a couple of questions if people would like to come to the microphone. Given the finding of the increased usage of product and diaphragm with partner acceptability, any thoughts about how we might be designing future studies to enhance adherence by engaging partners as well for these trials?
Yeah, I do think that it seems sometimes a bit as a dilemma that we are looking for methods that women can control and use discreetly, yet in this trial and in the MIRA trial as well, virtually all women inform their partner about product use, and it seems like partner approval is important. I think that it may vary by context. In Zimbabwe, it's a context where men are still seen as the decision maker for family planning and for HIV prevention, and therefore their approval is required. And probably engaging male partners, and my colleague Liz Montgomery will talk more about that later, but engaging the male partner in disease prevention methods or use of contraceptive will probably increase adherence.
Thank you. Dr. El-Sadr?
Yes, Wafa El-Sadr, New York. I'm sort of thinking about the whole issue of adherence in the prevention context, and in some ways we've accepted that in the treatment arena that use of antiretrovirals are what we call unforgiving, that you need to have 95% to 100% adherence with combination antiretroviral therapy in order to prevent resistance. It seems like there are perils somehow that will become evident in prevention, and maybe if we take what we've learned from the treatment world, where the intensive adherence support that's provided between visits as well as during visits, and sort of aiming for this whole idea that it's going to be sort of unforgiving adherence in a way that's going to probably lead us to success. So I think there dawned on me there are parallels from the treatment arena to the prevention arena, and if we keep in mind this whole idea of the unforgiving or the very, very, very high rates of adherence that we've learned to need to achieve in the treatment world.
I absolutely agree, and I think that one of the ways to deal with this issue is to develop methods or protocols that decrease coital-related use and user dependency, and that's one of the possibility with the diaphragm. In this case, this was promoted as a coitally dependent method, but it could be, for example, diaphragm could be used continuously and could be disaggregated from sex, and that has been shown in another study we published a couple of years ago to be associated with consistent diaphragm use. So I think there are ways, even with the methods we have now, to increase adherence by changing the way we promote and the methods to the women.
Thank you, Dr. van der Straaten. Our next speaker is Dr. Etienne Saguet, who represents a multinational team from Nigeria, Australia, and the United States, who will be discussing genital tract abnormalities among female sex workers who douche with lemon lime juice in northern Nigeria.
Oh, well, this afternoon. This morning, we're going to be looking at genital tract abnormalities among female sex workers who douche with lemon and lime juice in Nigeria. Vaginal douching for sex is a widespread practice among various cultures worldwide. And commercial antiseptics, soap in water and salty water are the commonly used agents. Douching with lime is one that has been reported well over 300 years ago, and it is still being practiced in many communities across the world. And we reported recently that it is a common practice in Nigeria. Some researchers have looked at lemon either as soft drink, that's the bitter lemon, the Crest bitter lemon, or lemon itself as having antimicrobial properties and can immobilize spermatozoa as well. And people have even suggested that it could be a candidate microbicide. Well, we know better than that now, that it takes more than just the credentials of immobilizing spermatozoa and killing HIV to be a microbicide. And so several workers have looked at the impact of lemon on cervical explant tissues. They say that the cytotoxicity of lemon is as bad as that of nonoxynon 9. And this was done by Lachman and Smith. These studies, however, are unpublished. There's another one, another work done by the Conrad team. They looked at sexually abstinent women who volunteered to use lemon and lime douche in different concentrations. And they did show that there was a dose-dependent epithelial damage on the cervix and vagina. Although in primates, this sort of evidence was not found in terms of destruction, because in primate research, they have looked at introducing lemon, they douched with lemon every day for a period of 1 month, and found out that there was really no evidence that there was destruction of the vaginal epithelium. So where does that leave us? The act of douching itself has its problems, and there's evidence that over 30 years ago, in the United States, there is a drug, a douching agent, Lysol, and other tar-based douching agents that were removed from the market by the manufacturers because they were associated with cervical cancer. Today, we are not sure whether lemon douching used for sex has that sort of effect. It has any effect, you know, impact on the vaginal epithelium, or it increases HIV acquisition. No one is really sure. It is true that some non-clinical research has been done, but this, we think, is the first attempt to actually look at what the impact of lemon is in women who have been using it. So the question there is, does lemon vaginal douching have, for sex have any impact on the lower genital tract epithelium? Now, this is a cross-sectional study of consecutive volunteers, and these are existing users. We commenced our work by advocacy and mobilization, and consenting brothel-based sex workers were recruited in Jos, northern Nigeria. And this study got ethical approval from the Ethical Review Board of the Jos University Teaching Hospital. The study questionnaires were administered by trained nurses who gathered information on vaginal practices, and the gynecologist who was blinded to the women's responses obtained pap smears and performed colposcopy on these women. And those who were found with abnormalities received treatment free of charge. The clinical procedure, that's colposcopy procedure, involved looking at the vulva under magnification, and that was followed by a speculum examination and visualization of the cervix, the fornices, the vagina, and then lavaging with acetic acid, and then performing colposcopy examination on these areas. And we sampled as appropriate. For statistical analysis, we entered, the data entry was done on EpiInfo version 3.3.2, and we tested for associations using the chi-squared and the odds ratio with 95% confidence interval. We used the multivariate logistic regression to assess the independent effect of lemon and lime use on the risk of cervical dysplasia. In all, we recruited 398 female sex workers. They completed the questionnaires, but because of a number of reasons, 24 of the candidates did not come back for colposcopy. The main reason, of course, was that a number of them were having their period at the time and were asked to come back after 10 days when they are all clear. But about 24 out of the 70 who were having their periods during the period did not come back. So we had 374 comprising 81 lemon users and 293 non-lemon users. Their age ranges between the lemon users and non-users was not different, 28.0 there, and the range and the mean, no difference. And then we have religion. Again, most of the people that we, most of the sex workers were Christians, but the lemon users were in the same proportion among the Christians and Muslims. Looking at marital status, the majority of people there were actually either single or divorced or widowed. Duration of sex work, it just showed there also that those who have been in the sex work for more than 5 years, this group, a higher proportion tended to be among lemon users. Now, the colposcopy findings were divided into those that were normal findings, those that had cervicitis, those that had warts, and those that had suspected squamous intraepithelial lesions. And using the colposcopy findings, we did not really, the differences did not reach statistical significance at any of the levels. Although you see 20% of lemon users there having abnormal squamous intraepithelial lesions and 15% of the non-lemon users, it did not reach statistical significance. But on cervical cytology, we did find that those that had high squamous intraepithelial lesions, 20% there, and then this 11.2%, that difference was significant. And when we added the low-grade and the high-grade squamous intraepithelial lesions, we found that the difference there was significant. Now, it was still significant even after we confounded for HIV status. And the HIV status, you see that among the lemon users was 48.8, non-lemon users 48.2. Really, there was no difference in HIV prevalence between lemon users and non-users. This statistic we'll find on another presentation that was done by the team and is out on the poster session. So in summary, we have looked we say here that there was a significantly higher prevalence of squamous intraepithelial lesions among lemon users in comparison to non-users. after confounding for HIV status. And there was no difference in prevalence in cervicitis or genital warts. And we found no evidence of abrasions or bruises. This study had several limitations. First, we relied on self-reporting by subjects and have no means of verifying claims. We could not control for other factors like degree of dilution of lemon juice, timing of douching, and the frequency of condom use. And because of the cross-sectional nature of this work, we could not be confident that lemon use preceded the development of dysplasia. And also, confounding by association may have arisen if the use of lemon juice associated with other practices that increase the risk of dysplasia. So in conclusion, we are saying that the practice of douching with citrus juice may be a risk factor of cervical dysplasia. And further studies to explore the association between douching and douching with lime juice and cervical dysplasia are warranted, of course, in communities where this practice is common. I've made this presentation on behalf of all the authors, and we are grateful to all those who supported this work. And the funding for the work came from public donation to the Mary Magdalene Project on www.aids.net.au. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Dr. Sergei. There may be time for one question. I see somebody coming to the microphone. Please.
My name is Eleanor Jeffries from Scarlet Alliance, the Australian Sex Workers Association. Look, there's a lot of... there are so many issues that I think sex worker communities around the world want to raise in regard to the way that the use of lemons as douching has been looked at and analysed by researchers. But I do have a specific question and wanted to follow up with a comment. My specific question is, were sex worker communities engaged in a way that meant that they had an involvement in this research project, contribution to the way the project was designed, contribution to the kind of outcomes that were being sought? I note that there was no acknowledgement of sex worker communities in this list, and I want to know, was that considered at any time?
You know, because of time, I just put it that we had advocacy and mobilization. Actually, the whole process of advocacy and mobilization was a period that we used to work with the sex workers. This took a fairly long period of time before we could actually start the research work. So we took time to work with them, and they made several inputs. We were going to carry out a study in the main government hospital. They said no, they will not go there. They will prefer a private place. You know, there were lots of changes we had to go, we had to do in order that we would meet with what, you know, they would be happy with. And they were part and parcel of the work, I would say. And if you look at the acknowledgements, they have said that we're grateful to all those who participated in this study. And they are the main participants. I didn't mention them by name, but yep, they were part and parcel of this work, and they participated in both the designing and the implementation.
Okay. Well, I guess I'd like to say that if they were such meaningful involvement of sex workers in your study, then it would have been a benefit to the audience to have mentioned that. But for the benefit of international sex worker networks and communities, those groups are not resourced enough to actually be in contact with other groups in their own region or in among African groups or with other groups around the world. So I would question how they are being resourced and supported to be involved if that simply includes resourcing sex workers enough to make the practical outcomes of what you're seeking to do a reality, when these this kind of research has to be for the benefit of the communities that are involved as well. It has to be for the actual benefit of the sex worker communities involved. And I think there's specific statistics that showed there, that you showed, that have a degree of cultural meaning already, and that is that sex workers have been involved in the industry longer out of the sample that you took, were not practicing lemon or lime douching, and that the cultural imperatives of the way that information and knowledge is passed among sex worker communities perhaps is an actual variable that should be considered in this, because sex worker communities aren't, these practices aren't operating in a vacuum. They're operating because they have cultural meaning and they have a perceived positive outcome for the sex worker communities that are involved. And if people that have been involved longer are choosing not to do those practices, then what is it about lemon and lime douching that means that the longer you're in the sex industry in that particular sample, the less likely you are to actually do that? That speaks to me more powerfully than a lot of the other things. And, you know, this isn't necessarily targeted at you, but the general approach of researchers towards lemon and lime douching in a number of different African sex worker communities has raised ethical concerns for sex workers all over the world about the way that our cultural practices are invisibilized when it's turned into a simple set of statistics. And actually, valuable information about sex worker cultural, like how we share our information, the way we share our information, becomes lost, which means that this kind of research, whether it's about microbicides or anything else, is actually stymied by not including the voices of sex worker communities that do have a high and critical understanding of these issues. I know I've taken
it's, no, it's a, it's a very important point, and we want to thank you for it, and I think you've made it very articulately. This is not the forum, though, to carry forward this discussion because we need to move on, but thank you very much for your comments, and thank you, Dr. Segay.
All right, we are halfway through our speakers, and so it's time for a really quick commercial break. For those of you who are interested in the Microbicides 2008 conference, there is a pamphlet on the table outside the door down here if you would like to pick it up to get a little bit of information. So on that note, we'll move quickly to our next speaker, who is Dr. Constantia Watada-Zosha, who will be speaking on achieving a 95% cohort retention rate in a phase 3 trial of the diaphragm and gel in Southern Africa.
Yeah, thank you. Just a quick correction. I'm just Constantia Watada-Zosha. I'm not a doctor. Good morning. I'm going to present on the high cohort retention in a clinical trial of the diaphragm and lubricant gel that was conducted in Southern Africa. The method of improving reproductive health in Africa was a phase 3 randomized controlled trial to examine the effectiveness of the diaphragm and lubricant gel in preventing HIV acquisition among women. A total of 5,045 women participated in the study across 3 sites with 5 study clinics. The clinic sites were based in Harare, Zimbabwe, Durban and Soweto in South Africa. The sites were a mixture of rural, peri-urban, urban with formal and informal settlements. The study participants were on average 28 years of age, ranging between 18 and 50 years. 45% had high school education, 23% were employed, 59% of these women were married, and 68% were living with a partner. The average age of sex debut was 18 years, and it ranged between 10 and 31 years. 22% had circumcised partners, and 20% did not know. The trial design assumed a 4.7% loss to follow-up over a period of 3 years, over an estimated HIV incidence rate of 4% across all sites. Loss to follow-up was defined as no closing visit with no HIV endpoint data. It is essential to limit loss to follow-up so as to ensure validity of results, and it was important to ensure loss to follow-up was not different by study group. Participants Participants were followed up quarterly for a period of 12 to 24 months, depending on their date of enrollment, and closing visits were done between 12 to 24 months, also depending on their date of enrollment. Before the trial was implemented, there were concerns about migration, long follow-up periods, which was a maximum of 24 months. There was also concern that those in the control group may perceive no benefit of staying in the study that long. In view of this, the following strategies were therefore implemented prior to implementation of the study. Staff was trained on the importance of retaining participants throughout the trial and how this could be done. Adequate resources for follow-up were allocated, and sites were encouraged to recruit many outreach workers so that the outreach participant ratio was manageable. Outreach workers were allocated space in the clinics. This enabled them to have one-to-one contact with participants while in the clinic and also establish a rapport with their participants. Community launches were done to sensitize the community. And most importantly, staff was trained to obtain very detailed locator information from each participant. Locator information that was collected from each participant was done for efficient tracking for tracking purposes. Information obtained included the participant's home address, phone number, and direction maps were drawn on the locator form where addresses were non-existent. We also obtained the participant's school grandchild's name, the name of the school and address. This was done to ensure that in the event that the participant moved from a current known address, the child was unlikely to change schools, therefore would remain a reliable contact. A second contact details was also obtained after the parent and relative. For each of these details, the participant was asked, indicating the initial that it was okay to either phone or to contact the participant by phone or post, and whether it was okay to mention that study name. The following strategies were used during the implementation of the trial. Reminder letters were sent to the participant's home before the next scheduled visit was due. If participant missed the scheduled visit, she was either contacted by phone or making home visit within 24 hours. In MRC Durban, peer educators were used for outreach. As the trial progressed, we improved our customer service to try and meet the participants' needs as far as their participation in the trial was concerned. We offered weekend and after-hours clinics for those participants who were finding it difficult to get home, to get time off from work. We created a suggestion box for participants. We provided transport for those who were living in areas where transport was difficult to access. A client liaison officer was appointed at each site to interface with participants regarding their waiting periods. We also played movies, family movies, and served refreshments in waiting areas. And for those participants who brought their children to the clinic, childcare was provided while they were having their visits. To encourage our participants to keep coming for their visits, we gave them token gifts at milestone visits, e.g. at month 6 visits, which was halfway through their visits. We also held a participant lottery. The draw was done quarterly for previous visits that had already been attended. And an incremental reimbursement was also done at the as the visits accrued. These small gifts and competitions were approved by IRBs. These were also done at different sites and not across all sites. We also focused on participants that we termed as hard to reach. These participants were hard to reach for one reason or the other. They either relocated or kept promising to come for visits. For those who migrated to rural areas or other towns, rural outreach trips were done to give these participants bus fare to come to the clinics. For those who said they did not have time to come to the clinic, a mirror team visited them at home and a closing visit was done in their home. And for those participants who repeatedly were difficult to bring back to the clinic, a coordinator or PI visited them at home just to talk to them, and sometimes this helped us bring issues that were happening at the clinic or in the field that prevented them from coming for their visits. And a final pitch for participants who had not closed after the last scheduled visit was done for 2 months to try and bring them all back to the clinic for a closing visit. This slide is just showing the visit adherence per visit per study group. As you can see, study adherence per visit ranged between 83% and 95%, and there was not much difference between those two study groups. Our last follow-up scheduled visit was done on October 4, 2006, and 89% of the enrolled participants had a closing visit. Intensive follow-up and tracking of participants who had not closed by this date was done for 2 months, and the closing visits rose to 92.5%. Overall, 4.3 of these participants were classified as lost to follow-up, meaning they never returned for a closing visit and had a final HIV endpoint. But for those who, there are some who didn't come for their closing visit, but some of these participants did some follow-up data and contributed some women months to the analysis, and others never returned for their enrollment. In conclusion, preemptive planning and continuous monitoring of retention rates combined with the additional tracking time ensured high return of participants. Achieving high retention is resource-intensive and requires proper allocation of financial, administrative, and human resources. Many of our successful strategies were staff-driven. Therefore, it is important to involve all members of staff in retention discussions and to share ideas across all sides. Thank you.
Do we have any questions for this speaker? Nancy?
First of all, you did a fantastic job.
Thank you.
But I just thought, now everyone's going to say, oh, we're already doing this, but I just thought of something that, and you know, insofar as you do per protocol analyses, given all of the problems that we have with adherence and measuring adherence, I wonder if we could think about using people who are difficult to follow up as maybe a surrogate measure of adherence, and to sort of look at people who are difficult to follow up per protocol or subgroup analysis based on that. And I think it might be interesting to see, because the hypothesis would be that those who were easier to follow were more likely to adhere. Just a thought.
Thank you.
I had a comment, sort of a question. What amazes me is retention is so important in these microbicide trials and the MIRA trial, and requires such creativity and really a lot of thought and understanding your participants. I think that it's really phenomenal that the staff for this study was really so aware of the needs of their participants and really considered that so carefully in trying to come up with solutions to make sure that their participants return. So I just think that that's really terrific that you were able to do that.
Thank you.
Yeah, I'm sorry. Up there?
Yeah, is it okay? Hi, my name's Anne Ferreira. I'm also a researcher from the Netherlands. And although my focus is on adherence, and I've seen a lot of issues with follow-up in children and the mums, and I really commend you on providing so many services, the transport, childcare, extra hours. I think these are all really fantastic things. I'm wondering if this wouldn't also be an interesting predictor of adherence in the future. We're seeing some, you know, in terms of return clinic visits. Even for people who require additional services. I don't know what your trial, what your plans are for, you know, continuation and follow-up, but that would be my question, is how much more in this phase or the next phase will they be expected to return, and how much more retention issues do you expect with, and therefore the adherence issues?
Can I?
Do you want to maybe summarize the question?
Yeah, I'm wondering if my question is really, do you anticipate when you're having problems with retention already in some, and having put so much effort into a clinical trial of this type, how much can we expect adherence without all of this attention and financial burden, especially in resource-poor settings?
If I'm sorry, if I hope I understood what you were asking. The trial is completed, so right now
this is phase three, right?
It's the phase three trial. It's completed, and the final result will be presented tomorrow in the late breaker session. So the retention rate you saw today is what we got. But we are planning to do analysis and see, and we actually did ask participants which were the best, their preferred way of contacting them, what they perceive as the most useful way to keep in touch and make them come back to the clinic, and we'll certainly analyze and publish that. And that may answer some of the questions.
Yeah, that's basically what I'm looking at, is what happens post this phase of the trial in terms of the continuing follow-up adherence post-phase of a clinical trial, phase three, because we don't have a lot of data coming through at this time on what happens thereafter.
We also followed a subset of participants post-trial, and this hasn't been analyzed yet, but we'll have data on that.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. I think since the last question was so lengthy, I think we're going to have to move on so that we don't lose our timing here. But perhaps if you wanted to contact the speaker after, you could ask your question.
Okay.
So I'd like to move on now to the next speaker, who's Dr. Elizabeth Montgomery, who will be speaking about female-controlled HIV prevention methods in Zimbabwe. How involved are the primary male partners?
Okay, thank you to the organizing committee for inviting me to present today. Perhaps I should also make a small correction that I'm not a doctor. The title of my talk today is Female-Controlled HIV Prevention Methods in Zimbabwe. How involved are the male partners? Before I begin, I would like to recognize my co-authors and collaborators at the UZ-UCSF program in Harare, Zimbabwe, the University of California, San Francisco, and my PhD supervisor at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine. In this presentation, I'm going to be describing the male involvement study, which is a sub-study appended to the MIRA trial. I will first give a bit of background on male involvement and then briefly describe the parent study, MIRA, and then go into the male involvement study and present some preliminary data. So despite being somewhat ill-defined, male involvement is widely promoted and presumed to be beneficial. Several UN conferences have issued official statements like this one from the Program of Action, from the Beijing Conference on Women, which states that the shared responsibility between men and women in matters related to reproductive and sexual behavior is essential to improving women's health. Promoting male involvement emerged in family planning realms, the idea being that if men were encouraged to come to family planning clinics or take part in programs, it would garner his support and improve health outcomes for women. The same logic has since been applied to the HIV-STI arena. And the hypothesized benefit of involving men has been corroborated by several qualitative and exploratory studies on hypothetical future microbicides and other female-controlled methods. In this research, which has been done throughout Eastern and Southern Africa, as well as in several other studies, there's been almost universal support for the idea that men must be involved in the process of testing and eventually using these new methods. Often respondents in these studies have cited potentially adverse consequences if men are not involved and later find out that their female partners have been using these methods. So it's unclear when women report that they want to involve male partners where this motive is coming from, whether it's out of a genuine desire to share or fear or a combination thereof. But despite the theoretical endorsement and exploratory research supporting male involvement, it's important to note that some studies have shown that promoting male involvement has, in fact, been shown to endorse men's authority. As in the Male Motivation Project in Zimbabwe, this was a social marketing campaign that aimed to involve men more in family planning and found that after the campaign, more men reported that they were the decision makers about family planning. So highly involved might also mean highly controlling, and this has been seen in a study in South Africa looking at gender and HIV risk. Finally, male involvement may have a neutral effect, and this is important information as well as we run around trying to involve them. So I'm quickly going to describe the parent study. You've already heard a little bit about it. MIRA was a phase 3 trial of the effectiveness of the diaphragm and Replenz gel to prevent HIV in southern Africa. We randomized 5,000 HIV-negative non-pregnant women to one of two study arms, shown here. It was a multi-site open-label trial, and all women received a comprehensive HIV prevention package. Women were followed quarterly for 12 to 24 months, depending on when they enrolled. The MIRA trial consent forms explained that male partners are invited to come to the clinic for free HIV counseling and testing, and staff were verbally encouraged to, staff were told that they should tell women that to invite their male partners to the clinic for any other reason. However, there was no formal intervention to get male partners to come in. The male involvement study was conducted, as I said, as a sub-study at the Harare site of the MIRA trial. Half the trial population, that is just over 2,500, were enrolled at this site. Participants were recruited from the community and municipal clinics in the area. This was not a high-risk population. The primary aims of the male involvement study were to measure quantitatively and explore qualitatively the effect of male involvement on women's adherence and acceptability to our study products. While these are the aims of the study, I'll only present some preliminary indicators of male involvement. I haven't yet correlated these indicators with the outcomes here. So there are 6 data collection sources for this male involvement study, the backbone of which is the male partner involvement form, which is a 58-item interviewer-administered questionnaire, which we conducted at 2 time points. The form was constructed from previous research and anecdotal discussions during pilot testing, and it explored domains of partner communication, participation, control, and attitudes about study products. So now I'll go into results. This is just a brief summary of our study population for the first 2,325 of the 2,500 women enrolled at the Harare site. Please note that 97% are married, and the mean number of lifetime sexual partners is only 1.3. So in the following slides, when I present data on partners, in the majority of cases, women are reporting on their husbands, and their husband is their only current partner, if not their only lifetime partner. So the data thus far show that the vast majority of women discuss joining the study with their partner, 98%. And in fact, they not only discussed joining, they asked permission to join. And as indication of the importance of this communication, 2/3 of women said that they would face problems at home if they joined the study without first asking for permission. Communication about day-in, day-out study participation is also quite high. 90% of women told their partners they were coming to the clinic the day of the interview, and over 3/4 said that their partner asks about their visit every time they go to MIRA. Around 2/3 of men remind her to go to her visit. So these measures of communication imply involvement, at least in terms of talking about the study. Men are not only highly aware of study participation, they are also reportedly highly supportive of women's participation and interested in the study. In terms of men actually coming to the MIRA clinic, there is perhaps a slightly conflicting picture. Whereas 75% of women knew or remembered from the consent forms that he was invited to come for VCT, and 93% that she said that she did invite him to come, only 4% of male partners came for counseling and testing. However, almost 3/4 of women said he would come for VCT if she asked him to. So here it appears there's a difference between communicating that he's invited to come versus the woman formally asking or insisting that he come. We did measure not only men coming for VCT, but for any other reasons, and 10% of partners did come for one of her visits. So this includes those who came for testing or those who just came and sat in the waiting lounge. We also looked at whether partners dropped her off or picked her up at the clinic, and 16% and 11% respectively reported at least one instance of this during the course of the study. In the MIRA study, we tested for HIV and STIs quarterly. Almost all women reported that they disclosed their HIV and STI results to their male partner at least once during the trial. Only 36% of women reported that their male partner had been tested for HIV, as far as she knew. And perhaps not surprisingly, the women reporting this were told his results. Of course, many more of these partners may have actually been tested and not disclosed results. In terms of our study products, 87% of women reported that male partners strongly supported or supported the idea of using the diaphragm during sex. Similarly, almost all women report their male partners strongly liked or liked the diaphragm, and many women report that it was not at all difficult to convince him to use it. We explored some other indicators of male involvement with regard to the diaphragm. While only a small proportion said that their male partner helped to insert or remove the diaphragm at any time, almost two-thirds said their partner asked about the comfort of the diaphragm, whether it was fitting correctly and how she was storing it or cleaning it. Finally, I have some preliminary data here on disclosure of use of the diaphragm and gel. Almost three-quarters of women reported that they overtly reminded their partner or told him that they were using the products each and every time they had sex. However, secret use was important for women. At least some of the time, 15% of women reported that they purposely hid diaphragm use at some point, and 12% reported they purposefully hid gel use. I want to acknowledge that there are at least two potential sources of bias with this study. The first is that women in the MIRA trial may be different than other women in the community, and in particular may have very different partnerships than most women, or they would not be permitted to join the study in the first place. Secondly, as with many data collected via self-report, the study may have social desirability bias. For example, women may have felt that study staff wanted to hear that their partners were supportive when really they weren't. So in summary, very few male partners came to the clinic despite open invitations. However, most women report that their partner was aware of her involvement, and the majority reported that he was supportive. According to women, there's a fairly high degree of support and approval. I think I just said that. During most sexual episodes, women communicated use of the diaphragm and gel to their partners, and secret use was quite rare. You may recognize somebody in this picture. The next steps in further analysis are to correlate indicators of male involvement from the intervention and not the intervention, the and the male partner forum with women's adherence and acceptability outcomes, and to correlate indicators of male involvement with biological outcomes, and then to look at characteristics of women with different levels of male involvement. Finally, I'd like to acknowledge the Bill and Melinda Gates Foundation, who supported the MIRA study and this sub-study, as well as the MIRA study participants.
Do we have any questions for the speaker?
Thank you for the presentation. I'm Dr. Nathin Choudhury from Bangladesh, working in Concern Worldwide. I'm very happy for this presentation, which I think is very relevant at the time of the HIV/AIDS we are going through, where feminization of the disease is occurring and involvement of male is very limited, I personally and professionally think. I have a few questions to ask, if I may. First question is that you said that the male have come to the only 4% came to the clinic, but their support was 95% to the women. Could you give me some reasons why this is the? Could you give me a little bit of in-depth understanding why this has happened?
You mean on the disparity between why they were supposedly so supportive yet didn't come? Well, we are doing some qualitative work with men and with couples to explore this more deeply. It could have been purely logistics that the men were working and weren't able to come to the clinic. Anecdotally, we've heard that they didn't want to come because it's women's, you know, perceived as a women's place, or they didn't see a benefit in coming, not because that they weren't supportive, but that they purely didn't think it was necessary to come in.
If I may ask the second question, is that you said no specific interventions were taken for the male participants. I would just like to know if there has been any study done where specific measures were taken for male intervention for them to be more involved.
Well, I do happen to know there have been several different types of approaches to encourage male involvement. Lots of sort of couples-based studies comparing couples' own approaches to women-only approaches, and those have shown that involving men is efficacious in terms of whatever outcome they are looking at.
Thank you. So only suggestion that maybe we should have more in-depth studies done, taking more intervention measures to involve the male in this type of trials. Thank you.
Up in the balcony.
Yes, my name is Harvey McAdon from Boston. I think these studies have been very interesting, and aside from the point of each one, they raise a sort of collective issue of sort of best practices of enhancing adherence to prevention methods. But they're very different methods. One is use of, you know, the husband's involvement. One is an intensive use of community workers who are involved in the study or study kind of investigators. And you could also look at a third model, which would be the sort of partners in health model of using kind of active members of the community as people who help with this. I'm just asking because I'm not a researcher, but a clinician and someone who tries to teach what are the best practices. Is anyone looking at what are the best practices to try and enhance women's participation in prevention activities? It seems like Nancy Padian may be the person to answer this question since she's involved in all the studies. But so I don't want to put you on the spot, but I just was kind of asking everybody in general whether that's being looked at.
Comparing the different approaches?
Yes.
Nancy, do you want to address that?
Because I
Nancy,
think
go ahead, but then
I think this is the main issue that's going to, like, this session will raise these questions, and these things will be repeated, you know, many times in terms of, you know, what are the best ways. Like, I can imagine going to Indy at the end of the week and hearing, you know, sort of comments about this session and about what husband's participation or, you know, whether it works or doesn't work. And I just think that it would be good to come to some sort of,
kind
of best practice.
Useful.
I think just my own personal opinion is there is a lot of sharing among the clinical trials. Many of the sites are doing multiple trials. I think there is a lot of sharing of these creative ways of improving the operations and the conduct of the studies. And I think that's being done not only in presentations like this, but also, you know, in private discussions. So I think that there is a lot, and we are learning a lot from all these trials that are being conducted, a tremendous amount. And I think it's terrific that this kind of information is being shared in this kind of venue. Nancy, did you have...
Well, I probably shouldn't have gotten up because I'm not 100% sure I understand the question, because I think the issue, or at least for our study...
The question is not the results, but the enhancement.
Right.
Who's comparing the different modes of enhancement?
Well, I think that Bobby's right. I mean, people are comparing it. That said, though, I think the fundamental issue, again, in our study anyway, was not what we needed to do to get women to participate. It's the adherence, which is the trickier bit. And so, I mean, absolutely, these methods are being shared, but getting people to participate in these trials and remain in them, I think, isn't it isn't as big an issue as I think you might think it is, if I understood your question.
I'm sorry, but I think we're going to have to move on to the last speaker. We're running a little bit late here. So our last speaker is Dr. Jeremy Paul, and I'm fairly certain he has a PhD.
Close enough.
Speaking on SPL7013 gel, VivaGel, a topical microbicide in development for prevention of HIV and genital herpes, shown to be well tolerated and comparable with placebo after 7 days administration in healthy males. Jeremy.
Thanks, Bobby. Hello, everyone. Bobby suggested, I'm going to present on a clinical study that actually directly involved males by testing the product in them. So VivaGel is in development as a topical vaginal microbicide for prevention of sexually transmitted HIV and genital herpes. I think the rationale for female-initiated microbicides is borne out in the extent of the HIV epidemic, the HSV epidemic in developed and developing world, and the link between HSV infection and increased risk of HIV. The active ingredient of VivaGel is a dendrimer molecule called SPL7013 that has shown activity in prevention of HIV and HSV in vitro and in animal models. In addition, we've seen significant contraceptive effect in rabbits and recent significant inhibition of sperm function in vitro, so potential as a contraceptive agent as well. Two clinical trials have been completed on the product to date, one in female volunteers and the one that I'll talk to you about today in male volunteers. The product is also currently under clinical investigation in two other ongoing trials through the STICTG group and the MTN group in sexually abstinent and sexually active females, and further expanded safety trials are planned. The rationale for conducting a study in males for a product that is intended for females, I guess, initially, first of all, we have promising clinical and non-clinical safety profile to date. All topical microbicides require a favourable risk-benefit profile, must be tolerable and must be acceptable, as we've heard, to sort of both male and female end users. When a product is used in women, it may result in incidental exposure in men, and eventually a product may be developed for use by men. Therefore, we must assess the safety and tolerability and acceptability of the product in men, hence this trial. When assessing the safety and tolerability in men, we have to take into account the different anatomies of the circumcised and uncircumcised penis, and therefore we stratify for circumcision status. So the primary objectives of the study was to assess the safety of the product compared with placebo when applied topically to the penile epithelium and urethral mucosa. Secondary objectives included the assessment of the systemic safety of the product, systemic absorption of the active ingredient of the product, SPL7013, and an assessment of the acceptability of the study products. The primary endpoints for assessment of those objectives were participant reports of genital signs and symptoms and observation of other genital findings that are listed there. Secondary endpoints included all other adverse events and lab abnormalities, plasma concentrations of SPL7013, and expectations and experiences of the study product. And data from the last point is to be presented in future, separately in future, so I won't talk too much about that today. To be eligible for the study, participants had to have signed informed consent, had to be healthy males aged at least 18 years of age, were negative for HIV and a range of other STIs, must have had no STI within 3 months of screening, had to at least demonstrate that they were able to comply with the procedures and restrictions of the study, even though some couldn't, and had to have no history of allergy, significant drug reactions or other complicating dermatological conditions. and no genital existing genital signs and symptoms or piercings. Participants receive 2 gram of the product applied topically once daily for 7 days. The study was double-blinded and placebo-controlled, and the placebo was the base SPL7013 gel without the SPL7013. Participants were randomised in a 2-to-1 ratio of active to placebo, and as I mentioned previously, were stratified according to circumcision status. The study was conducted at the Melbourne Sexual Health Centre in Melbourne, and the PI was Marcus Chen. So a total of 36 healthy male volunteers were enrolled into the study. So 24 received SPL7013 gel for once daily for 7 days, and 12 received placebo gel once daily for 7 days. And within those groups, half were circumcised and half were uncircumcised. There was a 7-day follow-up and a series of 5 visits throughout the study, and I've listed the range of assessments that were conducted and included a genital exam at each visit, as well as other review of adverse events and PK sampling and sexual history and so forth. The participants in each of the treatment groups were all matched according with respect to demographics and other baseline characteristics. The mean age of the participants in each group was similar across the groups, and a similar ethnic distribution as well. All subjects were considered to be adherent to the dosing regimen, which meant that they had at least 6 doses. And the mean daily duration of exposure to the product was also similar between the groups, at approximately a mean of about 9 hours. In terms of the assessment of the primary endpoint, looking at genital events, there were 12 participants who reported at least 1 genital AE, 17 in total. All of those AEs were assessed as grade 1 or mild. And there was a similar proportion of participants in each treatment group who had these genital AEs. 15 of the AEs were assessed to have a potential causal relationship to the study product, being possibly or probably related. 25% of participants had experienced those in the active group and 33% in the placebo group. And there was no statistical difference between the proportions of participants in each group who had those AEs. The majority of the AEs commenced during the 7 days of treatment as during the assessment period, and a majority had a duration of less than 24 hours and often as little as 30 seconds. Excuse me. The most commonly occurring events were penile or genital itching. 12% participants in the active group and 8% in the placebo group, and penile redness. Again, 4% in the SPL7013 gel group and 25% in the placebo group. Again, no statistical significant difference there, and there was no apparent difference with respect to circumcision status. We also assessed, as I mentioned, non-genital or other AEs, and there were 32 of these in 19 participants. Again, all grade 1. There were some grade 2. All grade 2 non-genital AEs that were considered potentially related to treatment were in the placebo group. There was 1 lab abnormality, which again occurred in the placebo group. In terms of the absorption of SPL7013, there was none detected in the samples analysed, and that's consistent with other studies we've done both clinically and non-clinically. And in summary, the expectations and experience section, the SPL7013 or the study products were acceptable to men and would be considered acceptable if they are eventually proven effective at preventing STIs. So in summary, I guess the results of this safety study showed that the product was safe and well tolerated and comparable with placebo and did not result in systemic absorption of the active ingredient following the use of this product once daily for 7 days. And I guess this data combined with other clinical and non-clinical data suggests that Vivagel warrants further development and investigation as a microbicide. I'd just like to acknowledge there's quite a number of people there, but the study was funded under an NIH contract through NIAID, through Division of AIDS, and was conducted in collaboration with a range of collaborators at Melbourne Sexual Health Centre, NCHECA, the Burnett Institute, and other groups there. So, and I guess we, Star Pharma, is always interested in technical and scientific and commercial collaborations and partnerships. I've put some contact details there, and these slides will appear on the IAS website. So, thank you.
Do you have any questions for the speaker? I actually have a question, and that is, I believe that Vivagel may be unique in the terms of your development for two different indications, both genital herpes and HIV, and I wondered if you could just comment sort of generally about your development strategy.
Sure, yeah. We understand that Vivagel is the only microbicide to have an investigational new drug application with the FDA for both genital herpes and HIV prevention. The prevention of genital herpes is a key target for this product, and I guess the sort of likelihood that product is applicable in a developed and developing world setting, it has benefits in both regions. The rationale for pursuing the genital herpes indication. Everyone's trying to find new ways to do clinical trials and develop these products. And I guess we feel that the prevention of herpes indication, given the level of the epidemic in the developed world, perhaps gives us a different angle to pursue the development of that product. So I hope that answers your question.
Thank you. Anybody, any other questions? All right, I'd like to thank the speaker.
Thank you.
And I'd like to thank all the speakers who had wonderful presentations this afternoon, and thank you very much.